else is coming.
So we're not quite sure. Okay, good. So should we just go around the room, or?
Yeah.
Okay. So start with the side.
Oh yeah. My name's Nick. Okay. Yeah. I'm a lover of Bhagavad Gita Tuesdays.
Ricky?
Manoj.
Yeah.
What's that?
Vian.
Hi, I'm Anna.
Liana?
Anna.
Iana.
Anna.
I think spelling is a lot of it.
Hi, I'm Anna also.
Elena?
Chris.
Chelsea.
Michael.
Another Michael.
Another Michael.
Gala.
Dana?
Gala.
I'm Kim.
Nice to be back here. I really like this room. All the pictures. Just stand outside looking at the pictures. It's a very beautiful environment for spiritual discussion. Nice to see familiar faces. I've been here before, so I know a few people.
Thank you for being here today.
It's always my pleasure. It's always very difficult to fill in Joshua's shoes. So I'm taking the risk. But I consider this his blessing and his encouragement that we try and share with all of you. Few things that I've learned from the Gita and to learn from everyone. Every time I teach the Gita, it's the biggest learning experiences for myself. I walk away learning things. Every single time has been a unique experience. So, I hope and pray it's the same this time. So a little bit about myself. My background, my name is Rasanath, and I am a monk at the Bhakti Center. Also help manage the place, and I also run the educational offerings that we have at the Bhakti Center. And prior to being a full-time monk, I was an investment banker on Wall Street. So some people say it's the natural direction to take. So life is an interesting journey, and that's what I've seen. And I've been a student of the Gita for about 15 years ago. And I've been teaching the Gita, I would say sharing, since 2002, so about 10 years. So that's about my background. So Joshua told me that you were in text 8, chapter 4, which is a very, very important verse in the Gita. So I'll read the Sanskrit and then for those of you who are inspired to recite it, please feel free to listen. It's page number 192. Paritranaya sadhunam vinashaya cha duskritam dharma samsthapanarthaya sambhavami yuge yuge. Paritranaya sadhunam vinashaya cha duskritam dharma samsthapanarthaya sambhavami yuge yuge paritranaya sadhunam vinashaya cha duskritam dharma samsthapanarthaya sambhavami yuge yuge.
The words to decide. To establish the principles of religion, I myself appear millennium after millennium. So this is a verse, if you go to India, I was raised the first 21 years of my life in India. And this is a verse that you recite, start reciting when you're 4 years old. It's like poetry. And this is like a very standard verse that is taught in schools as prayer. It's a very important verse from the Gita. And one of the primary reasons why it's important is on the path of spiritual life, many times we are looking for assurance. As we are walking through, as we are taking this journey of self-discovery, it's always difficult to walk a path that is filled with uncertainty. Life is uncertain. I like to say that the world is a gray area. Right? We would love for it to be black and white, because then it helps us make our decisions very easily. What's interesting in the world is it's gray. And when it's gray, it's very difficult to see how to maneuver. And this grayness can be experienced in daily life. Right? We are always confronted with choices. And we, New York City, that's why the stress levels in New York City are high. Two reasons. There are goals and there are choices. Too much to achieve and too many things to live with. And, it's a statistical survey that they did in 2009, which actually showed that a lot of stress is created by choices that we have in life. So every time you go to a supermarket, if you walk by Whole Foods, most of us do who are shopping, right, so many different products to buy, and the same thing has five different labels. And each time you walk away with one thing, I'm always concerned then, am I missing out on something? So it creates a lot of stress. So because of choices, because of goals, and even within choices, then we make it more complex.
get confronted with choices in terms of what I should do with my life, what I should be doing with the vacation time that I have. And it gets even more, even further complex when it comes to relationships, which is probably the most complex field. It's like, it's great, you can't figure out this person. It's today it's like very sweet, the conversation's really nice, the next day it's just like, I mean, do I even know you? Right? And when it comes to people, this is what makes it so difficult, because there is a lot of greatness. We carry within us both the positive and the negative aspects. And so it's very difficult to label someone in a particular way. There is a lot of unpredictability in relationships. So, and then when we take it one more level deeper, the question about who we are, our identity, and our own process of discovering ourselves, many times leads us to those very gray areas within us. So now we are going from the outside world within, and we find a lot of grays. And usually, when we see the gray areas, it's kind of difficult to see the dark sides. And we like to push it under the carpet, and it's a very unconscious defense mechanism, right? It's just like to externalize issues. So it's very unconscious. That's how the ego deals with things. So when we embark on this process of self-discovery, there is a lot of uncertainty that we have to face. And as a monk, I can say that in 2006, when the financial markets were at an all-time high, is when I got my job offer. At that time, the sign-in bonus was, just to put a sign on a piece of paper, was $60,000. That's how much Wall Street paid. So it was around the same time that I developed a desire to give at least a part of my life to monastic training. And as soon as I started confronting that desire, and you know, some of the most deep, dark attachments that I had started to surface. Okay, if I give up this job, no medical insurance, okay, that's one thing. But then no one's going to, investment banker, look at the prestige that comes in. And you tell someone that I'm an investment banker. Of course, now it's a bad word. But at that time, it was pretty prestigious. Now if you say you're a banker, you're the 1%. So at that time, when I was seriously considering this choice of giving myself fully to monastic training, I started confronting some of my most deepest attachments. And I used to play them out in my dreams. So it's like one dream that I very vividly remember was just. Me not being anyone. When we come in touch with our own insignificance, it's actually scary. I will be no one. No one will really recognize me. And even after I became a monk, there was this deep temptation to tell people that I used to be a banker before. So kind of like getting the attention, getting the validation, right? That is needed for the ego to thrive. So when the ego faces, when the ego gets an impression that it's actually going to be dismantled, it just rebels. And one of the best ways that it knows to rebel is by, you know, throwing out all these fears. And the other dream that I played out was, again, you know, my family is a very big thing, you know, even now. And at that time, I was very concerned, afraid, worried, in anxiety about how my mother would react to this decision. So there was one dream that I saw, which was very scary, where I saw that my mother died on hearing this. This is not fun. But then I started playing out these dreams. Started playing out these fears through my dreams. So when you do go down to those areas of attachments, when the ego starts to really, when you really start confronting the ego, it becomes even more gray. And should I do this? Should I not? Am I assured of achieving peace, everlasting peace, liberation? These are very valid questions, because our flashlight only shows us so far, right? And we can only walk the distance that we can see. So, and especially when it comes to spiritual journey, it becomes a little more complex, because we see more darkness than we have ever seen before within ourselves. Because we do go down to those places when we directly confront the ego face to face. So, every bit of assurance, every bit of encouragement is very critical at this point. Because usually we like to get the ask for proof. Okay, show me that this works. But what is interesting with spiritual life, what makes it so special and so unique, is the uncertainty. Because if it were certain, where is the question of courage? Like the first question, if we have to do a difficult task, if you are doing a difficult yoga pose, first question that comes in mind, how long? Because if we know how long, then the mind has the capacity to kind of adjust and say, okay, fine, it's going to come to an end. Right? But what about a journey where you don't know where it's going to end? Or you don't know how long you have to go through this dark tunnel? Does it even have an end? So that uncertainty is what makes it so unique. I wouldn't necessarily call it exciting, although it can become exciting. When we are starting on the journey, I think that's what makes it an act of courage. Because courage means uncertainty. Right? Don't know the outcome. And so what Krishna does in the Gita, this is a very interesting situation that Arjuna is in. Arjuna is confronting things within himself. And at this time, it's one mechanism of the ego that I like to call the ethical side. Arjuna's whole argument that he wouldn't fight is because he feels it's unethical. When you dig down deep, what is Arjuna holding on to?
He's holding on to his ego.
What kind of ego?
His self-worth.
Okay, self-worth. What kind? It's funny, I'm having this...
his fear. At this point, he's still afraid. He's looking out over the battlefield and he's uncertain to the results.
Okay.
In the previous chapter, Krishna's like, don't worry, or chapter 2, I think, or 3, he's like, don't worry about the outcome.
Yeah.
The results are not the concern. It's how you process this information, how you do it.
Uh-huh.
That counts, your dharma. And he's like, okay, well then if it's my dharma, I want to go live in the woods. And I don't want to play. And then Krishna's like, well, no, because you have a duty. This is why you're here, to do this. You weren't born to be a sadhu. You were born to be a spiritual warrior.
Right.
So your duty is to fight. And okay. Then he's like, well, what do you mean by that?
Okay.
And so he's now talking about, like, well, I came to teach the Gita, to give you wisdom. And he's getting at this stage, he's talking, trying to talk Krishna off the ledge so he can, like, kind of clear his head and kind of come to terms with who he is and center himself.
Okay, good.
That's right, right?
Well, basically, you gave me the, you basically went through all the 80 chapters of the Gita.
Sorry.
No.
I'm a good teacher.
It's excellent. That's true.
Isn't he also holding on to his reputation?
Very interesting, right? Reputation, right? And if you look at Arjuna's arguments, they're very valid. I mean, any sane, rational person reading this would actually say, I mean, this is a very saintly argument. Right? Now, it's very interesting to see how many times we can actually make spiritual excuses for not confronting things. Right? So, here is a relationship issue. And we might very well say, well, the Courses in Miracles said that we should have a conversation when there is love, and right now there is no love between us, so I won't talk to you. So when you experience love, then we can have a talk. Avoiding the conflict. Right? Avoid the conflict. We like to think of ourselves as peaceful. Right? But behind the peace, there is something raging. And peace sometimes can be used as a mechanism to not deal with things. And Arjuna also had this this whole ethical ego mechanism, which actually said you have to be this guy who should not be going down in history as a person who killed his own family people for the sake of his kingdom, for the sake of a kingdom, right? For the sake of riches. So Arjuna was holding on to something, reputation, right? And sometimes reputation can come in many different ways. Sometimes it can be in pursuit of success. Sometimes reputation can be, let the world know that I've never refused anything. Generosity can also be a way of keeping reputation alive. But that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm doing the right thing. So the ego is very tricky, the way it works. Its mechanisms are very, sly. It can very easily convince us that, look at the cause. You're a peaceful person. You're an ethical person. But then if we drill down deep, are we truly confronting the issue? Why is it so difficult? Why was it so difficult for Arjuna to kill his kinsman? He was actually trying to run away from something. He was caught right in between attachment and duty. And usually the zone of conflict, this is what I say, usually the zone of conflict is when you know what the right thing is, but you're attached and not doing it. As soon as we face, it's every time we face an internal conflict, we know both things. It's just that we may focus on one. Usually it's the attachment. But when there is an internal conflict, there is knowledge of both. Even unconsciously, there is knowledge of both. And so, deep inside, you know, this is what should be done. But then, at the same time, this is what I want to do. So, this is Arjuna's dilemma. And the first chapter of the Gita is called the Yoga of Arjuna's Distress. Very interesting. Distress as yoga. So he is in this conflicted situation where he sees both those sides. He actually sees his attachment, but deep inside he also knows what his duty what his duty is, and his duty is to fight. So as we embark on our own spiritual journey, we'll come across several, not one, but several such crossroads. Where, based on what choices we make, the next challenge is thrown at us. And sometimes, if we make a choice not to move forward with our duty or not to do the right thing, then it's very interesting. The same test comes back again. It's like, you know, the SATs. You have to, if you don't score enough, you have to come back. You have to retake the test. It just comes back in a very different way. That's all. And if you have to make the right choice, then it takes a lot of courage. And courage, not just courage, has this very interesting feel to it. It's not that there is background music going on. You know, it's just like suddenly you feel like the hero climbs out of the. That's not how courage works. Courage has this feel of like obvious. I see it. Right? I don't know why I was conflicted. I see it. And it's just like a very natural course of action that doesn't require any external validation for it to live. But to get to that point of being able to see with that clarity requires a lot of digging and wading through stuff. And that requires courage. But when courage is at its peak, it's just obvious, it's just very natural. It's, yeah, I see it. It's just like the truth just becoming evident. And once the truth is evident, it's no one needs to force us to act. It's just like, it's a force on itself. I know what needs to be done. Just do it. Right? It's very natural. So, but then getting to that point takes a lot of work. And during that time, what is also very important is the kind of assurance, is the kind of encouragement that we get. And interestingly, Krishna happens to be Arjuna's charioteer. So this verse specifically for me, when I read it, it's Krishna's assurance to Arjuna that, don't worry, like, I am with you in this journey. Right? So when he says to deliver the pious and to annihilate the miscreants, this also has so this can be understood in several contexts. One is in the context of the battlefield, where Krishna is telling Arjuna, you will win. Here's the clue. Right? So don't worry about the consequence of this war, because you're going to win because I'm on your side. But also on a deeper level, there is also the sense of I'm with you to actually go deeper so that you can destroy the demoniac forces within. That's the other side to it. And this assurance is so critical, especially at a time when I usually talk about this verse. I talk about a very important concept that's dealt with in Christianity called the dark night of the soul. Does anyone know what the dark night of the soul? Do you want to share it for our benefit?
From what I understand, it's when you get to a certain point, it's everything goes in a direction where you're confronted with almost everything that you can imagine that's a negative in some way. And then after that, supposedly, if you get through the darkening of the soul and you're in a position for the light and the sound and the other things to come through. And it's kind of interesting because when I first read the Gita, okay, a little bit, I was a kid, I was a teenager.
Really?
And many years later, you can see, I became a professor. I did engineering. I teach psychology.
Wow.
And I did engineering and did a bunch of other things. And I probably looked at every conceivable world, religion, and different pieces. It just gave a whole different perspective. You know, the choices you're talking about. I think maybe sometimes the choices are, I think what we look at sometimes is the space between all the choices.
True.
So they're still there. There's something else that's deeper than all the choices.
Absolutely.
I don't know if I said that properly. But
no, it's true. Sometimes we think that we only have so many choices, then we have to look deeper to see that there are more.
If you walk around this street here, you can see 20 different types of yoga and self-improvement and everything from Scientology to Kundalini to you name it. It's here. And there are choices. It's true. What's right here? Sir.
That's true. That's true. I guess that's a doctrine of the soul in and of itself. You have to wade through all the choices. But going back to this point of doctrine of the soul, anyone else has any thoughts about the doctrine of the soul?
Doesn't it usually come after one has had this extraordinary experience of sort of that unity type of feeling, and then it doesn't end there?
Uh-huh.
One has to then go through this doctrine of the soul as a way to sort of chisel away
Good, good. There is definitely that element to it also. And that's what makes it so interesting.
And it's doubting that it's, you know, I think it was one of those saints. And then also Jesus Christ when he was on the cross, other God likes that for sake. There are these figures that have had these dark nights of the soul where they doubt.
That's right.
And you have to face that doubt and get to the other side of it.
That's right. Very good point.
I relate it to the shadows on the path.
Shadows on the path?
It's when, you know, as we're studying bhakti, or like walk around, like, oh, I'm yogi, and I ignore all the negative in my mind. And when I do that, I get further away from the truth.
Uh-huh.
And I don't confront the demons that are actually in me. That's what I would relate this to. And I like to call it the shadows on the path. That's
good.
A good book, too.
Oh, there's a book called Shadows?
Talks about that, like the duality,
yeah,
like the dark side also.
The other Michael?
You know, it's kind of interesting because this year I've been starting to show for my psychology class, especially in abnormal psychology, I actually show a picture of a great white shark being attacked by a human, and getting into how people react and why they're responding, about how it's really built into the nervous system. We have these autonomic nervous systems that evolve over billions and billions of years. Just say, well, you know, we're evil because we're going to do this and that and the other thing. It's really kind of built into our systems to survive. Okay, in one way or another, we have these things in our genes that say, you know what, you know, at some point we have a genetic past or a spiritual past or both that says we're going to feel anxiety if we lose our child because it was eaten by a lion. Okay, and then you know, if a great white shark is out there doing something and these fish are eating other fish, it's in the system. It has nothing to do with traditional ethics in that sense. It's really, say, you know what, if you do this, you're going to survive. If you do that, you're not. And there's another piece to the whole system.
Interesting you say that, because I've been thinking a lot about our own experience of anxiety and doubt. And especially really going back to this concept of anxiety, which is actually the name of a book by Soren Kierkegaard called Concept of Anxiety. You know, there is a basic anxiety about existence itself, which is what gives rise to existential philosophy. But then there is always this undercurrent of life and death, being and not being, you know, as we know of it as. And when I see that conflict, to me, what it means is, this is the start of my own spiritual journey. This is the biggest question that I had in my mind as an 18-year-old. Why death? Why should I die? What's the point? What's the purpose? What's the purpose of life itself? And the search led me to even internally understand that the very fact that I'm looking to live forever means I have an experience of it. Because I can only produce what I know. But then why the fear of death? You know, why this whole experience of mortality, which the Gita then says is false identification, which is what Krishna starts up in chapter 2, right? But then I want to just bring it back to the point of the dark night of the soul and the final doubt, if I may call it that way. And as you also stated that this last big test. Where what is interesting is deep inside, when you come to this place of the dark night of the soul, there is also a deep spiritual experience, which is why we have come so far. Okay. But at that point, there is this juncture where we hit, where it's like the door opens, right? And everything that you looked for can be proved to be true or false. That's it. And it's such a moment of test that it takes a lot of courage to actually go through that. If you read the lives of saints, this is like the biggest test, where after which the grace is just pours, and they become instruments of compassion in the hands of God. But that final test is like gets really dark. That's why it's called the dark night too. But and as you rightly said, there is also the experience. There is also a good deal of experience of, I would say, spirituality, experience of the essence, which is what has brought us this far. But at the same time, it's not over. It's not done. There is still one big doubt left, because it's like eating, right? I mean, something may taste really, something may smell nice, something may look nice, but the full experience of that happens when we put it in our mouth. I remember this really funny story. It's a true story to one of my friends. So this was a day in our tradition. We fast on certain days, certain auspicious holy days. So during fasting, usually what happens is, as the day is moving forward, each time you see food, it's a temptation. So that day, somebody, because it was a festival day, somebody had prepared a 3-layered chocolate cake. And throughout the day, this person was looking at it. It's just like, waiting for the time when I can break my fast. So the time came, he broke his fast. He had a big slice of that cake on his plate. So he sat down, put it in his mouth, and accidentally, instead of sugar, there was salt in it. So it's very funny the way he describes it. It's just like very, very funny, because what he said was the expectation was so high that when he first took a bite into it, he couldn't believe he actually changed the side. He actually took a bite from the other side too. Because the disbelief was so high. You know, he had to bite into it again to see whether it was truly exalted. Right? So, I mean, it looked very good from the outside, but then the final taste of it is only, you only get the final complete assurance that it is as delicious as it looks when you taste. It's a very similar experience with spiritual life. Get something?
Yeah, just remind me of something. Do you think we're afraid of death or the pain that happens just before death?
Well, I had a near-death experience, because this was 6 years ago when I was a student at Cornell in my master's in business. I think the pain of death, the pain of coming in touch with our own non-existence and the probability of it, and the fact that I am actually coming to terms with my own vulnerability, can be extremely, extremely difficult. And that was my personal experience. The first thing that came to my mind at that time when I was facing it was, time just dilates. Every moment is just like, it's like a movie playing in front of your eyes, where all the people that you loved, your deepest attachments, just start coming on in front of you. It's like, I have to leave all this. It's over now. It's kind of difficult to confront that. And the very fact that, what's going to happen, the uncertainty that surrounds it. And usually sometimes people say, I'm very peaceful, I can be very peaceful at the time of death. Sometimes resignation also seems like peacefulness. Now, last week, I was this neurologist who was giving me a presentation on the effects of meditation in the human brain. She was talking about this piece. It's an almond-shaped component at the back of the brain called the amygdala. Now, the amygdala is... it actually is like a fire alarm system for a building. So each time the person is in danger, it's like goes off, shuts off other parts of the brain. It's just like totally reactive component. And she was explaining how at the final stage sometimes the amygdala just says, okay, minimize the pain, just resign. So you see that in Discovery Channel sometimes. You see animals, like a zebra being chased by a lion, and then it knows it's going to be caught. Just like gives up, and the whole psychology of giving up is to decrease the pain that may come if So reduce awareness so that you don't have to face the pain. And we do this even in regular life, kind of decrease awareness. I don't want to see it. So there are very different mechanisms that we adopt to kind of deal with it. So long answer to your short question.
No, that's very interesting. Yeah, big delighted. Surgical memory, that we're constantly even recording pain when we're under anesthesia.
Right.
You know, the amygdala just keeps ticking. It's like the apple head.
Yeah.
The energizer button. Just keeps going no matter what. Car accidents.
Yeah, absolutely. So again, coming back to the point of the dark night of the soul and this whole cloud of uncertainty that surrounds our own spiritual life, the main point here is Krishna is actually assuring Arjuna, don't worry about it, because I'll be there with you. Right. And very interestingly, for me, this actually, courage is not a rational act. When I say rational, I can't convince myself to be courageous. So I can't talk myself into doing an act of courage. The whole experience of courage is an emotional act. It's an act of like, yes, gotta do this. There might be a rational component that supports it. But it's an act of the heart. And usually it's accompanied by an experience of the heart that's waiting on the other side to get it. Right. And that's why this assurance of Krishna is so important, because this is not just a logical assurance. This is a loving assurance. And when Krishna says it, he actually means it. And of course, the dynamic between Krishna and Arjuna is so beautiful that right from the start, Krishna is seated on Arjuna's chariot as his guide. And when he gives this assurance to Arjuna, it's a very loving assurance, saying, why are you worried? I'll be here with you. And he says, Paritranaya sadhanam vinashaya cha dushkritam dharma sansthapanarthaya sambhavami yuge yuge. He says, I have done this millennium after millennium. I have done this in the past. So you don't have to worry about it. Right, so this whole tone of assurance, this tone of encouragement, especially when you're at that time when you're facing the dark night of the soul, the deepest, darkest moments of choice, especially as we embark on our spiritual journey, choices sometimes become difficult. And at that time, having this assurance helps us take the next step. Having either Krishna directly, Arjuna was very lucky to have Krishna by his side, or even having Krishna's representatives, teachers, people who have walked that path before, who can give us that assurance that, well, you know, I have done this, and don't worry about it, you will make it. So that assurance, having that assurance is such an important component of our spiritual journey, which is why I personally feel spiritual life is always, it becomes easier when it's done together. Because there is that sense that somebody else is walking with me on this path, either a contemporary or a person who has already walked the path, who can also be a friend. So sometimes, you know, gurus can be too inaccessible. Now what's beautiful about this whole section is Krishna is very accessible to Arjuna. He's just sitting in Arjuna's chariot, ready to drive the chariot. Right? Although there's a shift in the relationship where Krishna becomes this instructing Arjuna on a science, there is still that beautiful accessibility that Krishna provides to Arjuna. So even when he's saying these verses, when he's declaring himself as God, there is one section in the Gita when we study chapter 11. It's this whole big declaration that Krishna does, shows his universal form as the Supreme. And as soon as Arjuna sees that, you know, you can see that accessibility starts to close, shut down. And Arjuna immediately tells Krishna, hey, I just want to see you as that street blue boy. So it's very beautiful to see that assurance and that accessibility come together. And if we have such a friend in our spiritual life, it makes the journey so much more beautiful, so much more enjoyable, so much more inspiring. So for me, this verse that Krishna actually talks about, delivering the pious and annihilating the miscreants, is giving Arjuna the assurance of the fact that I'm with you, I'm walking with you, and I've done this in the past, and I will empower you to do this. So move forward. So I'd like to stop here and open this up for a discussion, questions, comments. Yes?
Very well, I just want to make a comment.
Yeah, please.
Because it ties into the conversation last week, just about Dharma, because we're in the discussion about what it's all about.
Mm-hmm.
And here, you know, he's saying basically three different things. You know, his purpose, support the pious, not the miscreants, reestablish the presence of religion, the understanding of Dharma, and then when he goes to the end of the purport, he mentions Lord Chaitanya. And so that the way Chaitanya Mahaprabhu actually established Dharma was say it's through chanting.
Right.
So and chanting is big around her taking movies. I thought that was it's a very nice, simple way that we have in this time period to really shift and change the atmosphere, not only externally, but our
right.
So I just wanted to mention that and relate that to last week's discussion.
Thank you.
About Dharma.
Thank you. Dharma is the highest dharma is when we can follow a process that reveals our own identity. Because at the end of the day, dharma has four different meanings. On its simplest level, dharma is. Anyone know what the meaning of dharma is?
You know. I was running around last week. I didn't have a chance to listen.
It says that that Dharma is represented by the four legs of the bull.
Okay.
So it's mercy.
Yeah, those are the four. Those are the four legs.
Truthfulness, austerity,
mm-hmm.
cleanliness.
Right.
And those are directly related to different activities or non-dharmic activities.
Sure. My question was around the meaning of the word dharma. What does the word dharma mean?
Inherent quality.
Inherent quality, okay.
Duty.
Duty, okay.
Religion,
principles of religion. What else? I mean, how do all these connect? I mean, it's the same word. Same word, dharma. Sanskrit is an interesting language, right? There is a branch of linguistics called contextual linguistics. It's very interesting because you can use the same word in different contexts and it can actually mean something very different. Sanskrit is a reusable language. You can use the same word in different places and it actually can mean the same. So you said duty. Kim said inherent quality. Ekayani is saying principles of religion.
Standard operating procedures.
Standard operating procedures. Very interesting.
They do this, you know, very interesting. If you do these other things, the group will fall apart.
Okay.
So, you can say if you have miscreants on one side and pious people on this side, it's also they all have a heartbeat too. So there's something else.
Okay.
So even the bad people and the good people all have something deeper.
Okay. But again, coming back to the question of how do these connect? How do these connect?
It sounds like something, I guess, that you strive for or dedicate your life for,
okay.
Religion,
okay.
And so on.
So my first question to you is, how do you know what your duty is? So meaning of the word dharma means, dharma means duty. So,
dharma,
you know,
is that where you're going with this?
Well, not necessarily.
How do you know your duty?
How do you know it's in
your soul, dharma.
Okay.
How your astrology then?
Okay.
I agree.
But is it more around duty or is it more around, okay, if I do this then I'll get the good results?
No, it's more like the proper use of the energy, like what would be the proper use of energy for me in this lifetime. Like,
okay.
I am supposed to be a lawyer, but I go on and try to be a monk.
Okay. 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 Good. Okay. Are they good?
Balancing the responsibilities that you're called to do and what you feel or your soul tells you, what your senses are just telling you to do.
Okay. Okay. Good. Good.
What you enjoy doing, what you're still doing.
What you're still doing. Okay. Okay. This word vocation, right? Vocation. It's very interesting. So discovering a vocation takes a good amount of time. I've talked to, even at school, it's like when people are coming out of school, fresh out of undergraduate, after finishing 4 years of school, it's usually a dilemma. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. It's like I'm not sure, but I don't know, maybe I'll do this, maybe I'll travel around for a year. That's usually the choice that people make. So I travel for a year so that I discover or I unlearn what I learned in school so that I can really find. So dharma is a very complicated thing to discover. Like our own psychophysical natures, what are we supposed to do? It takes a while to actually figure out. Right? So on the basic level of duty, what am I supposed to do in the world? Right? That you can only realize when I realize psychophysically what my nature is, what my calling is, what my vocation is. So on that level, that is one aspect of the word dharma. So then that takes us one level deeper. Okay, so what am I psychophysically? Right? So going back to Kim, your point about inherent quality, inherent nature. So you can have inherent nature based on our psychology and inherent nature on our essence, our truth. Who we truly are. And both can mean inherent property. I know what I'm supposed to do if I know who I am. That's how the two are connected. So duty and inherent property, the way they're connected is I know what I should be doing if I know who I am. So on a simple psychophysical level, that's knowing our nature. And on a deep spiritual level, knowing our true identity, which is the essence, our soul, spirit. So the real actual meaning of the word dharma is, so if you take it down several levels, the deepest level, the meaning of the word dharma is, that's why it matches to religion. Because religion teaches what identity is. That's why dharma also refers to religion. So like for example, if you say, what's the religion of salt? What's that? Salt adds flavor, but what is the religion of salt? When you talk about salt, what comes to mind?
Salty.
Exactly. It's as simple. It's that simple, actually. You cannot separate saltiness from salt. That's its dharma. So dharma means something that cannot be separated. We come with it. It's our inherent property. Right? And at the core of it, that's the truth. That's why dharma can also be referred to as truth.
to see how all these are interconnected with the link. So, going back to your point about how establishing a Dharma, in the process of uncovering the truth, is through the process of at least one of the recommended processes, the process of chanting, where we can rediscover our own identity, so to create that connection, spiritual process.
What's the nice thing about this verse is because even though it's on a battlefield,
very good question. I was hoping someone would ask this question. It's a very good question.
Say it again.
What's the question?
The question is, if Dharma is, it's our nature, and nature would mean dynamic, meaning it changes. Is that, so does that mean our Dharma changes? Right? So that's the real conflict that we come to when we encounter that the Dharma of the body is very different from the Dharma of the soul. So the Dharma of the body will change over time because the body changes. So even in this one life, it's very interesting how many different Dharmas that we have had. Like, as you know, between the ages of 5 and 25, the main Dharma was what? School. Study. Right. That was the Dharma. Right. And then even in relationships, then there were dharmas, right? So, and, you know, there was a certain phase of life where you have to be obedient to the parent. And then that changes. And then after 25, you know, then you get a job, and then, you know, that becomes part. And then there's family, and then you have responsibilities towards family. That becomes dharma. So, one second. So even in this one lifetime, we see our dharmas shift so many times. Right? So dharma that is related to the body will change. But dharma that's related to the soul is unchanging because that's the soul's inherent property. That's why spiritual life, what spiritual life actually does, it aligns the dharma of the soul with the dharma of the body. So that's what karma yoga or karma yoga that culminates in bhakti is all about. It's engaging with the nature, but in a spiritual activity. So Krishna is telling Arjuna, right, fight because that's your nature. So based on his physical body, he's a warrior, he's a fighter. But what Krishna tells Arjuna again, he says, come at it from a place where you're fighting for my pleasure. That's the dharma of the soul. So when the two come together, then that becomes spiritual. Michael?
One of the,
oh, sorry, that's the first one.
One of the things I've been walking around with for like the last week, because I read every day, and is, and this is off topic, but it's something that I'm thinking about, mm-hmm. is Arjuna's relationship with Lord Krishna is so profound.
Uh-huh.
He's married to his cousin, you know, his best friend. They grew up together, they played together, they, you know, they studied together, they trained together, and he's a demigod of the sun god. I forget. His father is the sun god.
Arjuna?
Yeah.
His name is Indra.
Thank you. And he struggles with the truth. So I have to accept the struggles that I go through and not take it personally, because this guy who's so there and is having this conversation with God is still having a problem with everything. That's what I've been walking around with like the last week in my head, like coming to terms with that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. In the acceptance of struggle comes the humility.
Yeah.
To walk the path.
That's what I've been churning in my head for a while. It's like,
okay, this is true, this is reality, and again, coming in touch with our own vulnerability.
I'm okay with it. This is my thought.
Thank you.
There's also something about the importance of teachers as high status leaders. And we have these mirror neuron systems that tell us when we're little kids to listen to our parents because they guide us to help us live. And then you have teachers, and then you have people like, say, Krishna and Arjuna, who's a high status individual. So there's something inside his physical structure, his brain, says, you know what? He knows I'm going to listen.
So I think that's one element. But the other element is also a heart connection.
Yeah.
There's so much trust in that relationship. See, vulnerability only happens in a place where there's trust. Simple, right? I mean, Arjuna was such a warrior, such a fighter. He never lost a single battle. That's his record. And here he is, before the battle of his life, puts down his bow and says, I can't fight. It's like the best player of the team on the eve of Super Bowl says, I can't do this. It's too much pressure. I mean, look at the audience. Everyone is seeing. I mean, this is like the biggest war that was ever fought. And so the reason why Arjuna is able to do that is because Krishna, there's such a level of trust in that relationship. Arjuna can make himself vulnerable, and that vulnerability is what leads him to understanding the truth. And again, coming back again, it's tying it all together. That takes time. But then if the two come together, if there is courage in the person going through the struggle, and if there is a guide who provides that environment, safety, and the two come together, it makes a very dynamic combination. Yes. You know, take a relationship, for example, the person that you love the most, and the person asks you to do something. You don't know the outcome of it. You won't know the outcome of it. How will you react? How will you say?
If the person I love asks me to do something, I would probably do it.
Right? So it's a very similar experience. I cannot be exact. One is because I don't have the personal experience. Because it's such a fine line, the whole concept of the dark night of the soul is something that only when you experience you actually realize the beauty and the pain of it at the same time. In that sense of the term, I would say it's like a paradox. And the interesting thing with the paradox is you cannot logically explain.
Well, what pulls you out of the dark? Is it your faith?
It's faith.
It's
very
basic. So when we're in class, we have the ability to connect to that faith because we're in an open environment with other people that are connecting. When you're in the dark night of the soul, it's your faith, of your faith alone, not the energy from the room around you or from the pictures that you see connection.
And secondly, that's very well said. Very well said. Secondly, what also happens, what pulls you on the other side is there is this experience of love. There is something that you're experiencing deep inside that you cannot deny. But at the same time, you cannot confirm. It's like this, there is this push and there is this pull. And so at that time, the free will is tested to the maximum because the only thing that can help you make that choice is your own choice. You're left up to yourself. That's why it's such a test, because now it's you. It's, I would say, the complete exercising of free will that has to happen. That's why the uncertainty element is so crucial. Make sense?
Yes, a little bit.
Sure, we can all think about it, we can all think of like
Actually, that's one of the more pleasant stories. But there can be stories where it can be you're going through a really difficult time, and at that time you really make those choices of I'm going to take this next step. That definitely takes personal courage. And that's why I said, you know, the past previously, right? Any good remark. It's like your free will is left to its own to make a choice. That's what makes it so difficult. We also realize how much we are dependent. But that's the final test for the free will to care. I'm still going to do it. Yes?
I just wanted to try to answer that question.
Please.
So the question was, what happens at the end of the dark night of the soul? And the dark night of the soul is a breakdown in order to have a breakthrough. And so the end of the dark night of the soul is a breakthrough. And the difference is that at the end of the dark night of the soul, I'm no longer operating on faith. I now have this knowing.
Yeah,
so stuff is going to still come up in my life. It's not always a little rosy on this third dimensional plane. But there's always this knowing.
That's
and
right.
It's always in right alignment.
That's right.
Despite the appearances.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely right. Absolutely.
And nothing can take that away. So
that's
it's not
right.
Like I'm going to have another dark night of the soul. I'm going to go through some stuff. You know, maybe I'll get tested again. Maybe. But you know, there's always going to be that knowing. It can never be seen.
So after that, it's like, one of those scenes in the movie The Matrix that I get reminded of. It's like, you know, the dark night of the soul is like when he gets shot and finally he wakes up again. It's like the death that happens to the ego. And afterwards when you wake up, as you rightly said, it's like there is a knowing. And even after that there might be different tests that may come, but it's not, you know,
it's never started.
Yeah, it's never started then. Thank you. Good to see you.
We're getting close to the end of the class, so we have to make a couple of housekeeping announcements. That's okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Our usual announcements, please remember to help clean up and put everything together, the box for the books. Those behind us, please don't put books on the floor. Blankets go over here, pulse go over here, and blocks go over there. We accept donations, especially for our guest speaker tonight. And if anybody wants to participate in the Prasad for next week, talk to Kim to share. We'll tell you how to prepare for Prasad and what you're supposed to do and how to bring stuff. I don't know if we have any other announcements.
I have a quick announcement. So I'm teaching this course at the Bhakti Center. It's a 2-weekend workshop called Excavating Your Ego Type. It's a customized look into your ego functioning. It's a 24-hour workshop that spans across 2 weekends. We actually put together 2 frameworks. We use the Gita, and we use another framework called the Enneagram, and we actually put the 2 together in a very constructive way. And I'll actually go into customized look at 9 different ego mechanisms, its ways of functioning and the ways of coming out in the world. The interactive exercises, so you can come in touch with what your particular ego type is. If you're interested, it's $150 for the entire workshop. It's 24 hours, and that includes lunch. If you're interested, you can register. All the information is available on the course card on the site. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Very grateful to be here again.
Oh, okay.
Do you think there's a common theme between being a banker and a monk as far as risk taking and uncertainty?
That's a good one. I'm still investing.
There is.
But in a different kind of proposition.
Thank you. Is that the beginning of Gurdjieff and some of that?
Yeah, we'll have some we'll definitely talk about Gurdjieff.
You have a very smart background. Do you have a car?
I have a car, yes. So I do.
I should turn this off, right?